You're listening to Lament Configuration, a podcast about the shit that makes us sad. I'm horror author and film critic Gretchen Felker-Martin, and with me is my co-host,
Julia Griffair, horror graphic novelist.
And someday I'm going to nail that. I believe in you. But it's also like at the beginning of every episode of Comedy Bang Bang, they give the host Scott Aukerman a different incorrect title card. And this is like our version of that.
Yeah. Oh God. I guess it's like a running gag now.
Yeah. That's right.
Well. All right. I'm Julia Griffair, ferret breeder.
Yeah. Erotic skydiver.
That sounds cool. Sounds exhilarating.
That does sound cool. I would watch that.
Yeah. Well, you like cliff diving, so it seems like skydiving could maybe be for you.
I think I would try it, but I can't do any of the skydiving programs because I'm too fat.
You would think that, like, I don't see how it matters if you're, like, falling out of the sky. Everybody goes the same speed, right?
Yeah. That is absolutely correct. It's just one of those things where, you must be this thin to ride.
We attach parachutes to a space capsule. How much do you think that thing weighs?
Probably more than 30 pounds.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the maximum size for, you know,
for
what?
A space capsule.
Here's a sport that you have to be really thin to do. Cave exploring.
That is extremely true. You would not catch me dead in a cave, or rather, if I went in one, you would.
Yeah. Isn't that a convenient excuse to never explore a cave?
It's so good. People are like, do you want to explore the bowels of the underworld? And I'd be like, nope, I'm really fat. I can't go.
Oh, I would, but the entrance is the size of a microwave oven. And I do not care to. I'm a speepo.
I would prefer not to.
All right. We can do questions.
God, I hate caves. Yeah, let's
what do you
questions.
Hate? Caves?
All right.
Oh, yeah, they're terrible.
I hate caves. Terrible, terrible, terrible. This question comes from Hounds of Love. Do you ever have nightmares about scary concepts or characters from fiction? Does this shape your relationship to the works in question, or is it pretty relevant? Irrelevant. I do frequently have dreams about art that I really care about, but they're seldom scary. I once had a dream that there was a lost season of The Sopranos that had, like, ice skiing spy dinosaurs.
Whoa.
Yeah, and there were all these elaborate downhill chase sequences where Tony Soprano was on skis, and there were dinosaurs who were also on skis.
Oh, I think I remember this.
I probably told you about this.
Gretchen has incredible, elaborate, and deeply disturbing dreams.
When I have a dream that really upsets me, it's almost always about things that are not real, that don't have a real life counterpart. Like, I don't have scary dreams about American Psycho. I have scary dreams about suddenly realizing that a friend I haven't seen in a decade left me his thousands of geckos and I forgot to take care of them and they're all dead.
I feel like that is not the only time that you have had a dream about becoming responsible for an animal that you are unable to deal with.
Yeah, they're very regularly recurring. I just had that dream about a small toothed porpoise that I was responsible for getting into a suitable pool before it could be rehabilitated and released back into Boston Harbor.
That's so interesting.
Not that I would wish Boston Harbor on any living creature, but
no. But I think that you, in reality, you kind of tend to collect or attract needy people. People who are in process.
There's certainly been a pattern in my life.
And not even like in a way that is destructive, but just like people who want care from you.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to be nice about it because I know to a certain extent you like to indulge this. Like, there's a lot of times when people who don't know you very well make demands of you and I'm like, tell that person to fuck off. And you're like, I know, but.
you've actually been really helpful in helping me to moderate that impulse because even when it's not destructive, it's often pretty unhealthy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I do not feel fulfilled by being put in like a mommy role by strangers.
No, I hate that.
You know, like, and I feel like that's how a lot of people see me, which is an experience I share with a lot of other fat women.
Mm-hmm.
That mm-hmm. our bodies read as maternal, even to people who really don't know us, aside from casual exposure through online photos. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they decide to treat us. And I've gotten a lot better, I would say, over the last year at saying no or gently disengaging when people come to me like that. But it is definitely still something that weighs on me.
I think you also have a, like, at least in your online personas, like, very confident, authoritative. Like, we've talked about this before. Like, that's very attractive to people. Like, they find it reassuring.
Right. Most people really desperately would like to know what is going on and what they should do.
And, you know, to have that told to them authoritatively and forcefully and succinctly.
Right.
I, too,
which
would like that.
Which is not a skill that I've always... It's not a skill that I've always possessed. I mean, you know that.
Yeah.
I used to be much more wishy-washy.
That's true. But, you know, you seem like you know your business and what you're about. And I think that that's something that a lot of people envy about you. And, you know, I think that they, I think they're hoping that you will, they want to go to Gretchen school, basically.
Yeah. I think that's true, too. I know you deal with this too, but you're much better than I am at shutting it down or ignoring it.
Yeah, well, I think that for me, it's a little different because oftentimes the people who want help and guidance from you or who get fixated on you are young queer people, and you feel a certain responsibility to the community because, right. like, you're a visible queer woman and, you know, they need something from you that they can't get from maybe like the people that they know in real life.
Someone let all these ducklings out unsupervised.
Right, exactly. You know, I don't get that kind of, I get like baby cartoonists maybe, or maybe more accurately like middle-aged men cartoonists at the beginning of their careers, or so they think. you know, I feel no obligation to those people. Whereas if it was somebody that I felt I had a little more in common with, or that I felt some kind of like mutual, I don't know.
Like a sympathy.
Yeah. I also like, I have the excuse of like, my boundaries got much better once I had Frank, because
yeah,
it is always very easy to make the decision. Like, am I going to pay attention to somebody else or am I going to pay attention to him? And I couldn't make that call for myself. Like, I just, before I had Frank, was pretty determined to just give pieces of myself until I was gone.
Yeah.
But then after he was born, I couldn't do that anymore. So, and I think that's something that just kind of like gelled in my personality, like a chemical reaction. And I don't know how common that is. I assume that there are lots of other experiences besides having a child that can lead people to prioritize themselves and the people close to them. But for me, that is what did it. Having a child taught me to be selfish.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I mean, that is the social tactic that makes sure you'll survive.
Yep. As for nightmares, I think, is the question, like, do I dream about, like, fiction, like characters that I like and things like that?
Yeah. And then does it influence your relationship to that art?
No, I think yeah, not.
It's really not the case for me either.
I think I dream about like people that I know, and I dream about imaginary scenarios. Like I dream sometimes, you know, that being in some kind of a museum where you have to go through like a maze type of a thing, or being in an airport. I often dream about being in an airport and being having to go through customs. Like, my French is like fine, passable in real life, I guess. I'm very fluent in French in my dreams and just like desperate to get somebody to look at my fucking passport. I have a lot of dreams about torture. Like, when I have a nightmare, it's usually some really elaborate like torture scenario where I'm like being forced to watch or I'm like trying to hide, or it's not happening to me, it's happening to somebody else.
Yeah, my most common kind of nightmare is that I'm being followed or attacked physically, usually by someone who traumatized me in real life, and I'll try to scream and my voice will just be a hoarse little croak, and I'll try to resist and my muscles will be like taffy.
Yeah, that's a PTSD dream.
Yeah, I know.
I used to have dreams that my ex was smashing up my house with a bulldozer while I was inside.
God.
Yeah. Or else that I would dream that I had to kill him, like with a hammer or something, and he wouldn't die.
Oh, I've had dreams like that where I have to go through like an incredibly onerous process of murdering someone who won't stop trying to kill me or hurt me.
Yes.
And I have to I had a dream that I had to trap someone in a door by slamming it on their arm and then holding it shut while I beat their head in with a hammer, and it took minutes. It was terrible.
Yeah.
Or you'll keep doing things to someone, like, you know, shooting them, stabbing them, lighting them on fire, and they just won't die.
Like fucking Rasputin.
Right.
But I originally interpreted this question as like my own work. So I was thinking about, like, I often get ideas for horror stories from stuff that has been in nightmares. I think the example that comes to mind first is in the, what's it called? The beginning of the story before the story starts in Laid Waste.
Prologue.
Prologue. Thank you. In the prologue of Laid Waste, there's a scene where the main character, Agnes, is a baby and is stolen by the personification of death from her mother. And when her mother realizes this has happened and that her child is dead and buried, she runs to the graveyard and digs her up and finds her still breathing. And that's a nightmare that I had about my own child when he was like a toddler, I guess. He would have been about 2. Awful, awful dream. Really stuck with me.
That's so dreadful.
Yeah. And I wrote that as a comic, and then it was in a Kramer's Ergot, and I ended up, I think I was working on it at the same time that I was working on Laid Waste, and I was like, oh, like this really fits here. So
yeah. Just as a side note for listeners, the panel in which Agnes's mother realizes that her dream has a connection to reality is one of the best rendered expressions I have ever seen.
Oh, thank you. I was thinking about that the other day because I did a reading. That comic actually, the one page version of it, which is called Four Thieves, the one that was in Kramer's, won an award from the Society of Illustrators. Only award that I have ever won, I think. It's a silver medal for second best one page comic for whatever year that was.
Well deserved.
Thanks. So there was like a reading, or maybe these were two separate events, but we did do a reading of it. I think probably I roped Sean into reading it with me. And when I came to that panel, I screamed at the top of my lungs in like a very small room. And that was a lot of fun. So don't let anybody tell you that my readings are not dynamic. They're very exciting sometimes. So there. Sometimes there's screaming. I love to scream in a reading. There's we did a reading, and actually I've done this reading several times, of my comic River of Tears, which is about this man who keeps getting texts from his ex-girlfriend that she is suicidal and relapsing, maybe with an addiction, and he keeps having visions of her like very close on her face just sobbing. So it's intercut with scenes of him doing different stuff, like passing out drunk or like trying to make himself coffee. Or so when I do that reading, I cry really hard, you know, that like full body sobbing. Like, I never knew how to do that until, I'm not going to say what happened on the air, but something very, very traumatic happened to me. Yeah. I think I was 14, and I was like, what is happening to my body? Like, it's just a whole different type of crying. So, and I do that just like, my goal is to make it uncomfortable.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
And you linger on that shot for several panels in a row of just her, like, her face is all crumpled up, like, not crying in a pretty way, crying in a really gross way. There's like snot all over her face. And, you know, she's like gasping and.
Right. It's that type of crying where the emotion has seized control of your whole body.
Yeah. It's like being possessed.
Yeah.
So that's pretty fun to do, especially like it's unlike me. I don't normally do things like that in front of people. So it can be kind of cathartic. Oh God, I miss doing readings so much.
Yeah, I bet it is.
I would definitely recommend like getting up on a stage with your very personal work projected on the wall behind you and crying very, very hard in front of like 100 people.
That's so cool.
That's a real thrill.
I've only acted a couple of times, but I really get a kick out of it. It's so just exciting and engrossing.
It is exciting. I mean, I feel that you would be a good actress because you're such a versatile DM.
Oh, thank you.
You're great at doing a voice. You're an excellent mimic, and you have quite a range.
I'm beaming like a happy little cat right now. You can't see.
Aww. You can be in all my plays.
Thank you, baby.
All right, let's do another question.
Shall we move on? Yeah, next question. This comes from Desdemoniacal. I have a close friend who is trying to break into traditional publishing but keeps getting stonewalled and is extremely frustrated and depressed. I want to support her endeavors, but I honestly don't know how I can just say, keep trying, you'll succeed, when I feel so negatively towards trad publishing. I guess I'm asking for some advice on how to spin either indie publishing as a worthy avenue that doesn't feel like it's the choice that gives up on making art her career, or how to support her in her traditional publishing quest without just lying about the industry.
Okay, two things. First, you know, your loved ones are going to have goals that you can't understand. They're living in a different world with different priorities. You don't have to help her pursue traditional publishing. You don't have to reassure her that she's going to succeed. That is not the only kind of support that you can give. To support a writer in your life, you can read their work, you can tell them that you like it, you can bring them opportunities if you find them, you can brag about them to other people. You can do things to support your friend's creative practice without getting involved in their professional development. And as far as getting, was it her?
Yeah.
As far as getting her to understand or think about indie publishing or self-publishing as a legitimate outlet, I would say don't suggest it to her for her own work, but just give her an independently published book that you like. She can make that connection on her own. If it's for her, she will see if she starts reading indie work, if she has access to it. It's up to her to figure out whether or not that is where she wants to be. But, you know, yeah, it's not absolutely. It's not going to be helpful, I think, to just be like, well, have you considered doing this other thing that she probably is going to have a knee-jerk negative reaction to. But if she finds work that she admires, that she would like to emulate, and that work just happens to be indie published, then it might appeal to her a little bit more.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what you're describing is the exact trajectory of my creative writing career. When it started, you know, for probably 5 or 6 years after college, I was very diligently querying around, trying to establish some kind of professional foothold. And I had a very negative reaction to the idea that self-publishing could work for me. You know, I had grown up hearing about vanity presses, and that was sort of the whole picture as far as I was concerned. And it took my getting into independent art, first through comics and then finding, you know, prose novels and the whole world of independently produced art by people who were not involved in like corporate hierarchies, or, you know, who weren't agented and working with professional publishing industries.
And I wouldn't tell your friend this, because I don't want people to think of independent work as a stepping stone to better things. It's its own thing. But mainstream talent scouts do look at indie work to pick up.
Yes, they do.
It's a great way to get your work in front of people. So it's not like it is giving up forever on the possibility of mainstream publishing. Also, another thing. There are people who make a living from independent publishing and self-publishing that is not giving up on having a career as an artist at all. Like, depending on the kind of work that you make and how good you are at selling it, you will make a lot more money self-publishing than you ever can with a publisher.
Very true.
The thing that a publisher gives you mainly is the stamp of approval, the legitimacy, which is really important for marketing. And they can give you an advance. And they probably...
And they will also give you an inroad to a web of connections you may not have access to.
Right. That's true.
But in general, publishing is sort of a king-making moment where, like, okay, now the art is real, because the people who have the stamp have stamped it.
Right. That was the important thing to me about getting published by Fantagraphics, is that I was like, oh, like, that felt like I had made it. Like, I was, like, it was real.
Yeah, like, I felt similarly when Nightfire picked me up. But I think that I also felt really, really good by the time that I published, like, my second story on my own on Gumroad. That felt very real to me. The first one, I was sort of testing it out. I was emulating a lot of people like you, who I had met, you know, in a fairly recent time frame at the time. But once I got into it, it felt very real, and it felt like I would be happy to have the rest of my career in that arena, because it felt meaningful to me, and I knew a lot of people I respected. I guess my real advice here is, don't try to change your friend's mind.
Yes, exactly.
Give her support. You could say, let's say she comes to you and says, oh, I'm so burnt out on querying. I keep getting rejected. I just feel like I'm never going to make it. What you can say is, if you believe this, you know, I'm assuming you like your friend's writing, you could say, I love your work, and I'm sorry this is so hard. I hope that you catch a break soon. That's as far as it has to go. You do not have to be responsible for managing her dreams or goals or expectations.
Yeah, you don't have to help.
You just have to, you know, if you want to be a friend to this person, just give her your shoulder. It's going to be fine.
All right. Next question.
All right. This comes from Squillette.
Hi,
Dear
Squillette.
Gretchen and Julia, what are your favorite things to draw / write?
Ooh.
Sex. I love to write sex.
Love to write and draw sex.
It's just like...
It's the best. It's just endlessly interesting.
It is. And it's so, in a modern context, sort of underexplored compared to like action and dialogue.
Yeah, we will talk about this more next week. But people are afraid to be creative about sex scenes. I think there's a real chilling effect with, you know, people talk about, oh, can you believe that somebody would describe this in such a stupid way, or like people in this book are like having sex in a way that I would never do it. And
right.
But there's an infinite variety of ways that characters can express their sexuality. Every new sexual encounter is a stage, a play within a play, for a conversation to happen between two or more characters, that it's always really exciting, really fruitful, inherently intriguing. Most people find sex interesting and would like to see other people having it.
Very true.
For narrative reasons or not, including me.
And really, really, once you realize that sex has not just like infinite permutations, but there are then infinite ways to describe those permutations.
Yes.
it's just such a playground. And it's such an interesting way to pick apart how humans connect to each other and lay all the pieces out in front of you and start reassembling them in different ways.
It's really fun. Very fun.
And it's like the physical machinery of experiencing emotions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And experiencing connection. And it's just so immediate and important. And it unites so many people through commonality of experience.
Yeah. Sex is one of those things that most of your readers will have done and on right. some level will be able to physically connect to.
Yes.
And it's great to take those opportunities in a story to make a touchstone where your reader can connect, not emotionally or intellectually, but like physically, they know the feeling of the thing that is happening. It's yes. great to locate big believer, parts of your story in the body.
Big believer in the art of sensation.
Yeah.
I also love to write torture.
Yes. You write similar wonderful reasons. Torture.
Thank you, Julia. I believe that was one of the first things that you said to me about my writing, and I was tickled pink about it, and I still am.
I'm a real connoisseur about writing about yeah. torture. So
I would consider you a contemporary expert on the subject.
Yeah. I got a book about it open right now on one of my tabs. I'll tell you about it later.
Yeah, of course you do. Torture is another way of knowing yourself and of connecting to other people. And it's in some ways sort of a bastardized version of that, because so often what it involves is taking the version of reality you want and then forcing another person to mirror it by hurting and maiming them. But yeah, it's so fascinating to me. And the physical sensations of being tortured and the psychological effects those sensations have on people, the sort of breakdown of the self that can occur shockingly quickly.
Mm-hmm. Writing about like pain is fascinating. Like physical
yes,
pain.
Yes, it is. The Body in Pain is a great book on the subject, and it's sort of about how language around pain is very underexplored in English, like describing different kinds of pain and just the experience of pain itself. It's all very sort of virgin territory linguistically.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're here to change that. I also really enjoy drawing hands. I know a lot of people don't like drawing hands. For me, it is the most expressive part of the body, perhaps even more so than the face. I love to draw like a series of gestures between people touching each other. I like to draw people kissing. I already said I like to draw people fucking, I guess. And that's another thing that I know not everybody likes. Every artist has like a couple of things that they just cannot and will not do and always struggle with. So often feet or hands or kissing or staircases. Or for me, it's cars. I'll never draw a car that is convincing. I think I said on Instagram recently that all my cars look like ducks. Also kind of struggle with dogs. I can draw cats. I can draw horses. Dogs, something about, I don't know.
Your dogs are very good.
And to you. I know well, I could do better. Maybe.
I do not often draw, but when I do, I enjoy drawing the loose skin under eyes. I like to draw a funny little snaggletooth mouth. Mostly what I draw are like funny caricatures and cartoons. I was much, much more interested in visual art, making it myself as a kid. But as an adult, I'm much more inclined to write. Mm-hmm. I like to write dreams too.
Mm. Oh yeah, that's fun.
Just an excuse to sort of take all the paint and squeeze the tubes at the same time.
Did you ever read The Crying of Lot 49?
Yeah.
So you know how like maybe 25% of The Crying of Lot 49 is this fictional revenge play?
Yeah.
That's like, I love that. I love to have like a interlude that's part of the story, but not.
Yeah, there's a great play within a novel in Gene Wolfe's book of the New Sun. I think the second book ends with this whole, like, the format changes to, like, the script of a play.
Oh, nice. And
with blocking and everything. And you just read along with it as it happens. And the book ends still within the fiction of the play.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's, I think you would, you might really enjoy that book. It's very, well, no, those are all things you love too. It's like boring and
yeah,
intricate. Gene Wolfe really loved Borges. So there's lots of labyrinths and like time mysteries and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, me too, obviously.
Great book.
Yeah. It must have been you who made the recommendations channel in the Discord, right?
Yes, it was. Why did you do that? Asked me to.
Well, good for them.
Well, I thought it would be nice if we had a centralized place to do it so that
I could mute it.
You know, yes. And also so that the main chat would not become just giant lists of movies.
No, yeah, that was smart. You do so little modding. I was like, what's this?
Yeah, whenever I think to like take up the authority of the mod, I feel very self-conscious and I don't want to be the bad guy.
Yeah, I understand that.
I've given a couple of people warnings for stuff that surely was not meant maliciously. But other than that, I feel sort of at loose ends about how to mod a community.
I like to just delete messages that I find objectionable and not say anything about it.
I love that.
It is honestly often the best way to do it, because if you confront somebody about it, they'll be like, oh, I didn't mean it like that. I'm so sorry. Why would you do this? I don't know. Like, you have to have a whole conversation with them about it. But right. If it disappears, then nobody else has to read it. So there's no damage done. And the person may not even notice. And if they do, they'll be like, oh, that's so weird. I don't know what happened. Just sneak in there and prune. All right, next question.
That's a really good idea.
Thanks.
All right. This comes from Rug Tower. To Julia and Gretchen, if there were no copyright law, is there a particular famous thing that you would use in your work? Do either of you find it appealing to use characters/stories that have the kind of history, meaning, or charge that fame brings?
Not really. I mean, I write fanfic sometimes, and if that was, I would love to like legitimate it, just like release it as part of the expanded universe. But as far as like my personal work, I don't think so. Maybe if it's like a story that has a certain universality, like the Arthurian legends, those show up in my work sometimes.
Right. And those, of course, are already public.
Yeah.
Which is like the first thing that sprang to mind was that the only pre-existing fictional character I would really want to write about is Dracula. And I can already do that.
You can do that. You can have as many Draculas as you want.
Any book can have a Dracula.
Every book should have a Dracula. That's the first thing that I ask people is when they tell me that they've written a book is like, who's the Dracula?
Yeah, how many Draculas are in it? Yeah. I'm just imagining like a children's book, like everyone can have a Dracula.
Everyone can have one. As many as you want. If you can feed them, if you have a place to keep them, you can have a Dracula farm.
Clean up after them.
Yeah. you can explore a new career in Dracula husbandry.
Using other people's art as like a foundation for mine or incorporating it into mine, if it's not like folklore or some sort of commonly held cultural story or legend, is not terribly appealing to me. Though, I mean, I do write and enjoy fan fiction.
I have no like,
but that just
dreams of like, maybe someday I'll get to write an X-Men comic or something like that. I don't want those characters.
I feel like maybe a few years ago, if you'd asked me, I would have been like, I would love to write an alien movie or something. But at this point, I feel almost totally certain that any project a large company would hand you is going to be mandatory garbage.
That's true. And here's the thing. I like my ideas better than anybody else's ideas.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I don't want to work on someone else's project.
That's what, like, because I'm a visual artist, like, people, a lot of people think they can write a comic and would like a good artist to draw it for them. And, like, I don't.
Boy, sure.
First of all, like, the two adults that I'm closest to in the world are two of the best writers that I know. So I if I wanted a comic written, I am set as far as that goes. And I've drawn comics that Sean has written in the past, and we work really well together. I like that. But yeah, generally, I want to draw my own ideas. I don't, my yeah. ideas are better than whatever crap I could pick up elsewhere. To me, not objectively, I don't know. But only I can dream up the exact fantasy that pleases me. The exact exactly. thing that I want to see. Those eggs can only be served in my mind.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Just like even having people to answer to about Manhunt, the last novel that I finished, was a difficult experience for me in a lot of ways. Even though I think in this particular case, the book is stronger and I really like my editor and I liked working with her. It was a big adjustment, and I am not typically a willing collaborator. You know, I've worked, you and I did that unicorn story that you illustrated. I enjoyed right. that. But like, aside from you and Sean, I haven't worked with a lot of people, and I don't want to. Because they're going to give me a bunch of ideas that are not my ideas.
Yeah.
And that's well and good for them.
It's for the birds, man.
Yeah.
And oh, here's the other thing that is really exciting. I don't know if you realize this. If there is a character in a story that you like and you wish that you could put them in your story, you can do that. You can just do that.
Yeah, just change their name.
Just change their name. This probably is... unless you word for word recreate their backstory, nobody is going to know. There's just nope. like an infinite variety of people in the world. So you could just coincidentally have a similar guy.
This is Flinkus Pillbottom, and he's definitely not Han Solo.
That's correct.
Shall we move on to another one?
Uh-huh.
All right, here's another from Hounds of Love. How do you guys handle being shown art by family or friends that you consider hacky when they think it's good? Is there a way you've found to navigate this, especially if they ask for your opinion?
Yeah, so, nobody needs your real opinion.
Yeah, it's not important. And I say this as someone with like an overactive sense of honesty in a lot of areas.
Where and a
I
lot really of opinions. Like to tell people. She also has.
Yeah. I'm a very opinionated person. I'm not terribly polite about expressing my opinion, but, and this is key, that is the persona that I have and the behaviors that I choose to enact in my professional life where I'm a critic.
Right. It's not, in interpersonally, it's not useful.
No, it's not important. You know, my mom will tell me, oh, I really love this mini series about some Secretary of State. And I'll be like, oh, that's really cool. Why don't you tell me something about it? Because what's important to me in that situation is I love my mother and I want her to feel like she can talk about her interests to me so that, you know, she will feel that reciprocally and our relationship will stay healthy.
And you can find something, you can find something interesting in it.
Absolutely.
You can find something to like or something worth discussing. The art is not really the point.
No, it's not. I think that if you're talking with someone who's on a very different artistic wavelength than you, and you care about that relationship, you should be gentle. And you should not really think about being brutally honest or having like an opinion supremacy war.
You should try and come around to how they see it. Have a lot more fun.
Yeah, it's a very interesting experience. Over the summer last year during lockdown, my mother and I watched a lot of television because I was helping out at home, and then lockdown lasted you know, 8 months instead of 2 weeks.
Right.
But at first we watched what I wanted to watch, and that wasn't like a decision that I forced, but I suspect, and I feel fairly certain about this, that it shook out that way because my mother thought that if she suggested something, I would shoot it down.
Mm-hmm.
And not without reason. You know, I was a much snottier, younger person than I am now.
We've all aged a lot in the last year.
Yeah. And eventually I sort of gave her the floor and said, well, is there something that you've been wanting to watch? Maybe you could pick the next show. And I guess all that I'm really trying to say here is that, you know, it's like we were saying earlier, the art is not the point. If you have these fundamental differences on art, there are probably still things you can get together on, and the relationship is more important.
It's very tough when somebody shows you a work of art that is special to them and you find it so objectionable that you're not able to, like, if it's somebody who knows you well, they can tell that you're not with them on it. And that is tough. And all you can do is be like, this is not for me. You know, maybe I'm not seeing it in the right moment. Or I think the important thing is to affirm for them that you don't think less of their taste because they like this thing, or you don't think less of them. I think Absolutely. That's so much more important than any, you know, deciding whether work is hacky or meaningful or whatever. It's
I mean, on the few occasions that you and I have like split over a movie or a book or something, that's really all it took to get past it, is just like, well, you know, it's not for me because these are the things I value and these are the things I did, but like, that doesn't really matter. And it doesn't change how I think about your taste or like, you know, your quality as a person.
Yeah. I mean, like, we understand each other's, like, we have differences in the aesthetics that excite us sometimes, and we still like respect each other's opinions and tastes. Like, I have never seen a movie that you thought was really great and been like, actually, this movie is not very good. You know, it's the most that I can say is just like, this is not, it doesn't do it for me. Like, what's the movie about the girl who like kidnaps the boy and kills him? Or like she
The Loved Ones.
Yeah. Like, I really enjoyed watching that. But like, it didn't.
But at the same time, it's like too glossy for you.
Yeah. There's just like, the movie has a magic that didn't work on me. Like, I'm missing the connectors that it connects to. So I can be entertained by it, but it's not like powerful to me the way that it is to you.
Right. It's not getting its hand inside you.
Yeah. And that's fine. But
and that is,
I don't
something
think
that
it's
per
finished.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you.
Oh, okay. That's something that will occur in every relationship, no matter how close you are and how similar your tastes are. I mean, if you lined up 100 movies, Julia and I would probably agree on 99 of them. But there are still going to be moments where our preferences diverge, and you just have to decide what matters to you in those moments.
So there was a viral tweet that I saw today, not yours for once.
Thank God.
And it was somebody talking about how, I believe it was a woman saying that her friend's roommate's boyfriend that the friend's roommate was dating at the time, they like watched The Matrix together, and he was like, oh, so everybody just left The Matrix on principle, and they all got mad at him because he was like overthinking The Matrix or whatever. She mentioned that he had a barcode tattoo, which is annoying and also like a thing that a lot of people had around the turn of the millennium. And I almost quote retweeted and talked about this, but I decided that I didn't need to stick my oar in there at that time. But you're listening to the podcast, so you get to hear all my thoughts. I am 100% that guy. Like,
yes,
I'm very much on the side of staying in the fucking Matrix. And here's
why. Why wouldn't you?
Like, everything that you care about, including the other people who apparently are sharing the reality of the Matrix with you, like, those relationships are real. That it you know, the unplugging from it and like talking about like the bare bones of what makes the world with all illusions stripped away, like there's a time and a place for that. But I think that this is sounding like the most drunken philosophy I've said in a while. But you know, the real essence of what makes life worth living is caring about other people and finding ways to commune with them.
Yeah, it's human connection.
And there's no work of art that is worth sacrificing that, I think.
There isn't.
Now, if somebody does that to you, you know, if you show somebody a work of art that you think is really meaningful and they're like, oh, this sucks actually, that's bad behavior. That's why do you want to have a relationship with that person? Fuck that.
Absolutely.
They can schlorp out of the matrix and eat puke for the rest of their life in their fucking distressed sweaters.
They sure can.
I wish them joy of it.
Sit in a big giant hovercraft and run away from mechanical squid who want to plug them back into a battery. That sounds like a great time. Sounds like ass. Why would anyone leave the matrix?
I think there was a time
the machines did us a favor.
Yeah. When I was younger, where like I had some idea of objective truth, and I thought that, you know, at all costs we should all pursue the truth and whatever. I don't think that anymore. I think that relationships and communication, feelings, those are the things that give meaning to the universe. Those are the things that are more real than the material that supports our physical forms.
I agree. I think that lies and fiction and tactful eliding of the truth are all behaviors that a healthy person should regularly engage in.
Yeah, I don't think lying is that bad. I was thinking about this.
No.
As people of our milieu tend to do, you know, like I have so many traumatized friends, and I over the years, like I've had friends that I have said to myself, like, I think this person is lying often. They're saying that they did things that they didn't do, or they're, you know, coming up with ways to make themselves more interesting, or just lying about inconsequential things. And what I realized is that I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
None of those lies materially affected me. Like, it was not detrimental to me to believe that, like, you met a celebrity that you didn't really meet or whatever. Who cares?
And I think a lot of that kind of behavior, too, will naturally drop away with time.
Yeah. Anyway.
You've been listening to Lament Configuration, a podcast about the shit that makes us sad. You can follow us on anchor.com and listen to our podcast wherever you shop for your podcasts.
It's
Apple, whatever. Leave us a 5-star review or whatever kind of review you want.
Visit us on our Discord. I'm not going to recite the web address of the Discord. Neither am I going to post the link because there's like stalker creeps in the mentions right now. But, you know, you can ask for it or something, or you can just use the figure it out. I bet you can figure out how to find it. Thank you for listening.
If you can't, enjoy being out in the cold.
Yeah. Loser.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Good night.
Good night.